dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world, one of whose most important and largely unnoted aspects is how enemies of this country could do immense damage, indeed catastrophic damage, to our society, to our economy, to our people, by attacking the electric grid that is at the very core of our critical infrastructures and indeed our way of life. A man who has given a lot of thought to this, both in his previous incarnation as a United States senator, including in charge of our energy issues in the United States Senate, and now as an author of a new and I'm sure quite best-selling book entitled Gridlock. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by former United States Senator from North Dakota, Byron Dorgan. Sir, welcome. Congratulations on the new book. Tell us a little bit about the thesis of Gridlock and what you were trying to get across with your work of fiction.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. Well, first of all, it's a book about it's a thriller about cyber terror. You know, when former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta left his post a few months ago, he said that the next Pearl Harbor attack against the United States might very well be a cyber terror attack. And I share that belief and concern. This book is a novel, a thriller. It's about those that wish to do America harm using the digital warfare tools or the devices that are available in digital warfare. And they would use a computer virus to help shut down the American electric power grid systems. And that would, of course, be catastrophic to our country. So it's a thriller, a novel. It's about cyber terror.
But it is a teaching tool about a very real nonfiction vulnerability. And you have been thinking about this, obviously, again, in your day job prior to becoming a novelist. How realistic is it, in your estimation, that this kind of vulnerability could be exploited by enemies like Iran and Venezuela, for crying out loud?
Well, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, as you know. I mean, the National Science Foundation did a study about the vulnerability of the American electric grid system. It was immediately classified and not released for 5 or 6 years. It's been released now. And, you know, the assumption is that we have a grid system that produces, that moves electric power to the American people every single day. We take it all for granted. It's the end of our fingertip on a switch that we use. And but the fact is, we have an old system. We have not built a superhighway of transmission capability that is robust and that is protective against the new threats of the digital age. So this book is a novel, but it's also about a very real potential, and I hope will stir people to understand we have a lot of work to do to protect our country.
Yeah. You know, Senator, one of the things that has been most worrying to me is, as you say, it's a somewhat rickety, jerry-built infrastructure that is at the core of all of the other critical infrastructures, food, transportation, telecommunications, medicine, water, and so on. And we're at the cusp, at least in a number of states, of trying to upgrade the grid with the so-called smart grid technology. And I wonder if you've been struck, as I have, by the fact that if we don't build resiliency into the smart grid, it may turn out to be stupider than the one we've got.
You're absolutely right about that. I mean, you know, there are a lot of terms around smart grid and smart metering and all these things. The fact is, we have a grid system that moves power around this country that is fairly archaic. I mean, we've patched together a lot of grids that used to exist alone surrounding a power plant. And they would produce power and ship it to their neighbors with electric wires. We've patched those together in, you know, we have three major interconnects, Eastern, Western, and Texas. Then we have 127 control centers, highly computerized. But we've never really built a robust national grid, and there's no one entity really in charge of our grid system, as you know.
Yes, indeed. One of the things that has been troubling in terms of trying to get attention paid to this is again, you know, Senator, so well, is that there's not only no one entity that's really in charge, but the vast majority of these utilities are in private hands. And there seems to be a certain, well, if not indifference, at least reluctance to see investments made that would harden the grid against not just, and I'd ask you to broaden the lens just a little bit with me, if you would, beyond the cyber warfare piece that you focused on in your new novel, Gridlock. And again, our guest is Senator Byron Dorgan, formerly represented the people of North Dakota in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives for some 30 years. But the problem is whether it's space weather or whether it's other kinds of electromagnetic pulse or even just physical attacks on transformers, one of which took place in, as you probably know, in a substation outside of San Jose recently. We're looking at a vulnerability that our adversaries are very well aware could be exploited to our detriment. And yet, we seem not to be getting the attention of the electric utilities and, for that matter, even the government, really, to corrective action. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. It's more than just electric utilities. We now have big investment banks that are selling electricity, as you know. We've moved into this deregulation phase where we've deregulated the markets for wholesale and retail electricity. That creates price competition for lower prices. But the question is, who then is going to collect the funding necessary in these prices to strengthen and modernize and make more robust the grid system? The fact is it's just not happening. And the threat to the grid system is very real. Now, our threat comes in our book from Iran and Venezuela. I mean, they hire a drug-addled hacker in Amsterdam named Decker, and, you know, he starts shutting down power city by city in the U.S. But, you know, it's fanciful and it's a novel and fiction. But the fact is, the threat is very real.
Yeah. And again, having sat on the other side, the oversight side in the Senate, the policymaking side in the legislative branch, what would you do, Senator Dorgan, to remedy this vulnerability, knowing what you know, and hopefully arousing the American people as you're doing with this work of fiction, to ensure that the grid is in fact made more resilient in the face of these kinds of threats?
Well, there's work going on every day with respect to that. In fact, our government, I mean, there have been some stories about it, our government is actually hiring reformed hackers to help try to find defenses for these new digital weapons. The new digital age has produced wonders for us in many, many ways in our lives, but also new threats. And these, the digital weapons don't explode, but they can be every bit as devastating and perhaps even more. The National Science Foundation conclusions were that, you know, if you were able to shut down the electric grid system in our country, not just for days or even a few weeks, but a few months, it would wreck the American economy, put the lives of a lot of Americans in danger. It would be devastating to this country.
Indeed, there are some estimates by the chairman of the a previous panel that studied this issue of electromagnetic pulse threats to the grid, as you know, Bill Graham, to the effect that some 9 out of 10 of us won't make it if the grid is taken offline for perhaps a year or so. This raises it, of course, to the level of urgency, especially if solar storms might be a precipitating cause. The good news, as I understand it, Senator Dorgan, is that if we take steps that can harden the grid against all of these threats, the EMP, the surges, and so on that they might precipitate, we will do much to mitigate the dangers of cyber warfare against us as well. But we certainly need the level of attention that you're trying to bring to this problem and the kind of urgency that I think your work of fiction, Gridlock, is suggesting is needed. And I salute you for taking the time and energy to, if I can use that expression, bring us all a level of awareness that is so very needed at this time. And I hope as you make your rounds promoting the book that you will be heard on the policy side, both among your former colleagues as well as the American people more generally?
Well, I certainly will do that, and I hope people enjoy the book. It's available everywhere. Of course, download it through Kindle or from Amazon or the local bookstores, to the extent there are many bookstores left, as you know.
Indeed. Well, there certainly need to be, and Amazon is always available. With David Hagberg, our guest Byron Dorgan has just written Gridlock. Please check it out. Summer reading and, frankly, homework for us all. Senator, we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, Roger Noriega, former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, joins us to talk about Venezuela, among other things. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we often are by our friend Roger Noriega. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and Ambassador to the Organization of American States. He's now a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the driving force behind a terrific web resource called InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. Roger Noriega, welcome. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Much to talk about south of the border, as is generally the case, and all too much of it going unnoted in a lot of other places. We're very appreciative of you keeping an eye on it and talking with us about it from time to time. Let's start with this latest arrest of a leader of the Gulf Cartel in Mexico, apparently close to the U.S. border. When we last spoke, Roger, there was reason to be concerned that judges in Mexico were letting some of these guys loose. What do you make of the fact that we still seem to see some interest, at least on the part of the federal government there, of rolling up these cartels?
Well, they have, since the new president took office at the beginning of this year, arrested a number of serious figures in the in the narco world, key kingpins that threaten not only Mexico but the United States. And this recent arrest of someone from the Gulf Cartel, which is not as powerful as it used to be, but which is still an extraordinarily potent force, is reassuring news. What we need to see is whether this will be continued with a broad-based strategy that will take on the cartels in a serious, systematic way. Arrests, picking people off at the top, is not going to be sufficient. You have to have a broad-based strategy to take their resources away and to make it complicated for them to do business across the border.
Not only must it be a systematic but sustained effort, it seems to me, and it remains very much to be seen whether that's what the government of Mexico under its new leader is going to be engaged in. We're talking with Roger Noriega, a former senior expert and policymaker in the Western Hemisphere affairs at the Department of State. He is also currently a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And Roger, you've been warning assiduously and for quite some time, including in congressional testimony and various writings at Inter-American Security Watch and elsewhere, about Iran in our hemisphere, what it's up to. This is arguably one of, if not the most dangerous regime on the planet. What are they in fact doing, and how does what they're doing square with what the State Department recently reported was their waning influence in the region?
Well, it's a classic case where the State Department is telling the Congress that Iran's influence is waning, when a year ago they wouldn't have said that Iran had any influence at all. So the first time they are forced to pay attention, they minimize the threat. What's interesting is that the Congress, the House of Representatives, had two hearings on the State Department's report on that subject of Iran's influence in Latin America, and 7 of 8 witnesses said that that was a completely ridiculous, unsophisticated, unserious approach. And a couple of U.S. senators have written and insisted on a review of that report. What Iran is up to is carrying its terrorist threat to the border of the United States and certainly into our neighborhood, using Venezuela's platform, evading sanctions to abet its illicit nuclear program, and recruiting terrorists right here in our neighborhood. And there is fresh information from the Washington Post about that network of Mexicans and other Latins carried off to Qom in Iran to study radical Islam. This is a profound, growing threat, and the State Department needs to wake up before it's too late. Other security agencies in the United States have also said that that report that the State Department sent up to the Hill was complete nonsense.
It's really malfeasance, it seems to me. It's not just a dereliction of duty. They're misleading actively policymakers on the Hill and others about the character of the problem. And as you say, the Washington Post featured prominently a story about the Iranian outreach effort. And Roger, just to drill down on that for a moment, the fact that they are converting Mexicans obviously makes the problem much more difficult if these are jihadists but appear to be, or at least are able to present themselves as just any of a number of other illegal aliens coming in from Mexico. That makes the job of countering this threat in our own country, let alone dealing with it in neighboring ones, that much more difficult, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and we've been talking about for years the fact that other security officials in the region have complained about sleeper cells, sleeper agents going for training in Iran and returning to their South American countries to do Lord knows what. But we need to find out and be prepared to confront the threat.
Indeed. Roger, just as a sort of follow-up to our conversation about John Kerry's visits to the region last week, two of the countries that were the object of his attentions, Brazil and Colombia, seem to be running into all kinds of difficulties. I'm not going to suggest that this is as a result of John Kerry's visit, though who knows. But tell us what's happening in Brazil. There's a boomlet, I'm told, for Lula to make a comeback there? And also, what does it mean that there's apparently now an increasingly violent sort of general strike taking place in one of our most important allies in the region, Colombia?
Well, actually there is some sort of relationship. I'm not one of those people who says the United States is responsible for every problem in the world, but certainly the Brazilians need to have an economic partner to talk sense to them about opening up their economy to create jobs for their people. And the anxiety that people are feeling in Brazil that the government can't take care of all of their needs and that you need to have a private economy that's growing to create jobs is what's driving people out into the streets, and certainly a dissatisfaction with the current vision of the Brazilian president. It's hard for John Kerry to talk free market policies to Brazil since they don't seem to be particularly committed to them here in the United States. But that's the sort of dialogue that we need to have. And the second thing is that we've encouraged President Juan Manuel Santos to seek a peace with the narco-terrorist group known as the FARC in his country. That's something, anywhere these guys see a peace negotiation, they think that it's automatically good. But the problem is it's a narco-terrorist group that's committed to political violence as well as moving drugs across Colombia's border and threatening most of the hemisphere. These are not the kinds of people that want to see agrarian reform. In point of fact, they're revolutionaries, and they are committed to insurrection. So the idea that they're legitimized by a political negotiation with the Colombian government then empowers them to serve as sort of spokesman for the dispossessed in Colombia, and you actually see that playing out. So I think it's a fair criticism that part of our vision happens to have the effect of undermining what the Colombians have been trying to build there, which is a free market economy committed to democracy and human rights. And we need to get behind that message and not making a phony peace agreement with narco-terrorists.
And the trouble, as you know so well, Roger Noriega, from your time at the Department of State, it's not just that the end result is unlikely to be a real peace. The process itself of, as you've indicated, legitimating just by negotiating, by sitting down with these guys, can have very pernicious effects as well. Roger, we'll be following that closely, as I know will you, at the American Enterprise Institute and also at InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. Keep up the great work. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll be speaking with Andy McCarthy about the latest in Egypt, the effort by the government there to contend with and ultimately, we hope, suppress the Muslim Brotherhood. Straight ahead.
go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Presidential Task Force reported yesterday about lessons learned from Hurricane Sandy. The main one seems to be that we must make our electric grid and other critical infrastructures more resilient. True, but it's not enough to add robustness against the ravages of deadly storms like Sandy to the systems we rely upon for access to things like food, water, fuel, and medicine. The grid also has to survive electromagnetic pulses, or EMP. The main difference between the two is that it may take years to get the power back on after an EMP event, not days or weeks, and many of us won't make it. Let's take the lessons of Sandy to heart to secure not just communities, but the nation as a whole. There isn't a moment to waste. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. One of the high points of my week is the chance to visit with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, turned pundit at National Review Online and PJ Media, also the author of myriad best-selling books, including most recently, and certainly extraordinarily topically, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic democracy. A lot of illusions being crushed at the moment, Andy, at the hands of, well, on the, we'll be talking about with Nina Shea momentarily, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but also what's been developing with the interim government there and the U.S. elite's response to all of this. Walk us through, Andy, the latest developments, the arrest of Muhammad Badi, the spiritual guide of the Muslim Brotherhood. What do you make of it all?
Well, I think that the military, obviously, the armed forces in Egypt have made a decision that the Muslim Brotherhood needs to be neutralized as a force in the country, and they've set about doing that. And, you know, that's unusual in our modern experience that, you know, one side decides that they need to achieve complete victory over the other side.
Yeah, what a concept.
Yeah. You know, up until a little over half a century ago, that was the idea. But, you know, I think the military has sensibly decided that, you know, if they leave the Brotherhood intact and give them what, you know, basically what Washington wants them to have, which is basically a standing eight count, they will come back and cause more trouble, and we'll be right back where we are now. So, you know, they've decided that the Brotherhood needs to be defeated.
Yeah. Andy, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week, I think. It's not just that there'll be more trouble. My guess is that the military of Egypt has calculated that if they give them another chance, what would almost certainly befall the military and the country is kind of what we see playing out in Turkey at the moment, with the military essentially decapitated in the sense of its leadership largely in prison, and certainly put out of business in terms of playing the role that it has historically played as a brake on these Islamists. Is that likely to be operating, do you think?
Well, I think that that's probably in their minds. Egypt has a different set of problems, of course, than Turkey does, Frank. And, you know, I think overlooked for us in all of this is the fact that Egypt is really close to failed state status in terms of its the catastrophic economic straits it finds itself in. And it probably even more than the specter of being hollowed out the way Erdogan has hollowed out the Turkish military, I think what Egypt sees is twofold. Number one, and this is the Egyptian armed forces, they really have a piece of virtually every industry in Egypt that's worth having a piece of. So they're very much trying to save their own lot as well as their own country's economy. And while, you know, Washington is dithering over whether to continue the support that's been provided by the United States yearly over the last 30 years or so, the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia in particular, have ponied $12 billion up instantly in the last few weeks, and they very much want the Brotherhood to be defeated. So I think, you know, right now the financial interests and the political interests of the military, given who their patrons are and what their patrons' agenda is, line up very strongly around the idea of defeating the Brotherhood, which also happens to be the best thing for Egyptian stability.
Yeah, well, and I think for our interest as well, needless to say. Andy, talk, though, a little bit about this as a practical matter. What do you think are the chances of being able to fully suppress the Brotherhood, given the research that you've done in your various books and, of course, your running commentaries, in terms of the both established nature of this Islamist, you know, Sharia supremacist agenda within the Egyptian polity, and most especially the character of the Brotherhood as a kind of stealthy, subversive organization for most of its life.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point here, Frank, because, and it's one I've tried to hammer away at, but with only varying degrees of success, and that is to make people understand that Egypt is an overwhelmingly Islamic supremacist country. The Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt is not Islamic supremacist because of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood wins elections because it's the best organized Islamic supremacist organization in a country that is substantially Islamist. And I think people do tend to conflate the two. That is, they conflate the Brotherhood with Islamic supremacist ideology and think that if the Brotherhood as an entity can be defeated, then Egypt will suddenly become a secular democracy. And I don't think that could be further from the truth. In fact, you know, there's a hue and cry, which I certainly understand, that says, you know, why isn't, I know you're going to talk to Nina about this, but why isn't the Egyptian military doing more to protect Christians who are really under siege in Egypt? And I think the answer to that is that the Brotherhood has managed to win every Egyptian election that we've had since Mubarak was toppled by conflating its interests with Islam and by Islamizing every single election. And part of the military's problem, frankly, right now, is if they're seen doing too much to defend the Christians, that's going to turn off a lot of Egypt's population. I hate to be blunt about that, but that is a fact. And I think it's a large explanation for why the Brotherhood thought that the shrewdest thing they can do, since they can't really militarily defeat the armed forces, is to turn their wrath on Christian churches throughout Egypt. Unfortunately, that's something that has a kind of galvanizing, uniting effect that sort of draws the Brotherhood together with the
lots of other Egyptians. Yeah,
yeah.
There's so much to talk about here, Andy, and we just aren't going to have the time to do justice to it. But I think the points you make are so trenchant. And one of the things that I've long believed contributed to this Islamist supremacist character of the population was the kind of safety valve that Mubarak created for his own regime by enabling the Islamists to essentially run, free reign, basically, in the state-controlled media, the state-controlled academic institutions, and the state-controlled mosques for the decades that he was the ruler. And, you know, as a result, the anti-Semitic sentiment, the anti-Israel sentiment, the anti-American sentiment, for that matter, to say nothing of the anti-Christian sentiment, is rife. But Andy, I'd also want to get your thoughts at some point, and it'll have to be, I guess, next week, on the prospect that as a result of the Obama-Cain kind of attitude that we ought to perhaps cut off the Egyptian military and punish them for not bringing the Muslim Brotherhood back in some fashion, maybe in early elections, maybe in a more direct way. We're likely to see the Egyptian military simply head to other sources for arms and support, notably the Russians and Chinese. But that's another day's conversation. Let me close with getting your take on the revelations last week, courtesy of the Washington Post and originating with Edward Snowden, that there were 3,000 or so abuses of the PRISM and other related National Security Agency intelligence collection efforts infringing upon Americans' rights. What do you make of it very quickly?
Well, I think that the, to point to the thousands of what turn out to be mostly technical errors deserves, the overall picture, which is that there are, this represents an error rate of something significantly under 1%. There's almost no human endeavor where you could come up with an error rate like that, particularly with a large, complex bureaucracy. And it turns out that a lot of the errors were probably unavoidable because they involved tracking foreigners with cell phones who happened to come into the United States, which is something that you can't predict. Those are exactly the people we ought to be watching.
Yeah, so. No kidding. It's a subject for a longer conversation. Andy, we have to let you go at this point, though. Thank you very much for sharing with us, as always, your insights into what the Islamists are up to and whether they would like to take things, and the folly of the United States government embracing and emboldening and otherwise empowering these guys. Nobody says it better than you. Keep up the great work at National View Online and PJ Media. Come back to us again next week if you would. Next up, as promised, Nina Shea will talk with us about how all of this is translating into mass destruction and murder, a pogrom, in fact, of Christians. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday morning from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by our friend Nina Shea. She is the director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute. She was for 13 years one of this country's commissioners on the International Religious Freedom Commission, a tremendously important organization. And she's the author most recently of a terrific book entitled Persecuted, The Global Assault on Christians, and has just authored a piece at National View Online on that very subject. And it is about that we're anxious to speak with her. Nina Shea, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
though the topic is not something I'm happy to be discussing with anybody, but if we have to, it's with you that I would like to. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on at the moment in Egypt, especially as it relates to various minorities, but most especially at the moment, it seems, Christians at the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, Frank, it's a story that most of the mainstream media and our political leaders have basically missed. This is the jihad that's going on right now against the Christian minority in Egypt. These are the Copts. These are the original Egyptians. They've been there for 2,000 years. It was a first century church founded in Alexandria in the year 50. And they are now, over the centuries, been reduced to, they were originally the majority of the population, and now have been reduced to 10% of the population. So the Muslim Brotherhood is blaming the crackdown and the coup, or the military intervention, or whatever you want to call it, on the Copts. Now, the Copts were one of the dozen or so factions that supported the military ouster of President Morsi. But they have nothing to do with the crackdown on the sit-ins or what's happening now against the Muslim Brotherhood vis-a-vis the military. But they are being scapegoated, and the jihad, the violence that's being directed to them, has resulted in over 50 churches being destroyed and burned and looted. Franciscan monasteries, evangelical Bible stores, Pentecostal churches, and of course many of the Orthodox churches, most of them were Coptic Orthodox, and ancient monasteries that were 1,600 years old for the first time in 1,600 years since they were created in the 5th century have not been able to hold prayers in these monasteries because they've been destroyed.
I've heard reports even of nuns being paraded as prisoners of war and abused. Of course, there have been many instances, as you know, Nina Shea, of some of these religious folks being murdered, raped and murdered.
Yeah,
in some cases.
There have been about a dozen murders of Christians in the last couple days for being Christian. Islamists have asked to see their identity cards, which shows their religion, and then they've shot them in some cases. The nuns, as you said, were paraded and jeered and abused and groped through the street after their monastery, their convent and schools were set afire, and the Al-Qaeda flag was hoisted above where the cross had been. This happened last weekend.
Nina, now let me just ask you, this is of course at the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood or other Islamists in Egypt at the moment, primarily. Unfortunately, as we'll talk about in a moment, it's not entirely an isolated problem, but it is particularly evident at the moment there. And yet we are being told by President Obama, by John McCain, by Lindsey Graham, by Kelly Ayotte and others, that we need to be encouraging the return, if not actually to power, certainly to a shot at power through some sort of new set of elections of the people who are perpetrating this. Is this evidence in your mind of being really on the wrong side in this struggle? And what are the implications, not just for the Christians, but perhaps for the Egyptian people more generally in the region if this persists?
The Muslim Brotherhood has been very patiently hiding their agenda, and now I think it's really coming out in this moment of panic. They have on their websites that the Christians are at fault for their ouster. They're scapegoating them. They're leading the jihad on their Facebook pages and websites. Their motto has not changed. Jihad is their way. The Quran is their law, and so forth. They want to see a Sharia state established, a hardline Sharia state. They wanted it to happen gradually so the world would get used to it and there would be a rebellion against it. And I think many, you know, millions, tens of millions of the Egyptian people understand what is happening and they have rebelled against it.
They want no part of it, in fact. And here we are telling them, again, presumably, to further compound what was already their sense that we were abandoning them, that they must nonetheless allow the brothers to come once again into the political process.
It's a diametrically opposed visions of society. One would be, dominated by Islam and forced. You know, Islam would be forced on the populace or everybody else would be suppressed. That is their vision of society. And it's incompatible with democracy, frankly. And once in, the fear, of course, is that they would be entrenched, that they would become like a theocracy like Iran, where the candidates are selected for their, the litmus test of being Islamic. So there's no way out. If you criticize them, you're accused of blasphemy and put to death. That's what happens in places like Iran or Pakistan. when they had the blasting law.
Yeah, this isn't just a sort of academic fear. This is something that was really beginning to manifest itself, of course, as you know, Nina Shea, in the period when the Brotherhood had absolute control in Egypt. Nina, let me turn quickly to another place where Christians are also being persecuted. And again, our guest is Nina Shea. She's the director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute and the author of Persecuted, The Global Assault on Christians, namely Syria. Syria has been a place that under the rather odious regime of Bashar Assad was nonetheless something of a safe haven for Christians, particularly those fleeing persecution in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East. What is their plight at the moment, the Christian community in Syria, as the civil war plays out there? And what might, again, the prospects be if the Obama administration and some of its Republican admirers are successful in helping the Muslim Brotherhood come to power there?
It's very dangerous for the Christians there. They are fleeing in record numbers. There may not, when the dust settles, there may not be any Christian community of any size left. They are being targeted by the jihadists, by al-Nusra and the al-Qaeda organizations who are dominating the rebel factions now. And I testified a few weeks ago in Congress with the State Department, not for the State Department, but with the State Department, and the State Department could not tell us how many rebel factions there were. They said that more and more popped up each day and that there were scores of them. And most of these are jihadi extremist organizations. They have zero tolerance for Christians or anyone else who doesn't go along with their program. So the Christians are fleeing.
And we are arming those very folks, it appears, and we're being told that there's some that are coming from elsewhere around the world, including our own country, to be engaged in and trained in the jihad, and God knows what that will mean for Christians, among other people in this country, as they come home. Nina, just last minute, very quickly, what chances do these Christians under such persecution have, whether it's Syria or Egypt or anyplace else, to find refugee status here in the United States?
Their prospects are fairly daunting because, one, they're afraid to go into the UN camps to register as refugees because these camps are also dominated by the jihadists who are persecuting them at home. So they are not even registered officially as refugees. And in my writing, I've been urging the United States to look beyond that. They've taken refuge in churches and monasteries and schools that are run by Christian organizations in places like Lebanon and Turkey. And that's where we have to go to find these people because they are not they're avoiding the UN.
We have to also recognize that at the United Nations, increasingly, as I understand it, Nina Shea, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is pretty much calling the shots as to who is a refugee, and that is a whole another problem because, needless to say, they want Muslims and, for that matter, it seems Islamists to be principally those brought into this country. A subject for another day's conversation. Nina Shea, thank you so much for the superb work you do at the Hudson Institute. Keep it up. Please keep coming back to us. The topic is grim, as I say, but it's one we need to be focused on because as these Christians go, so go, I think, the rest of us in due course if these Islamists have their way. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.